If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Get it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the cock. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Line engine, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent Breed is people!
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast is a fortnightly podcast about movies. All kinds of movies. Crime movies, science fiction movies, horror movies, movies with cool actors you've never heard of in them, movies where CGI stands for criminals, girls and ice picks, classic movies, cult movies, and any other movie Terry wants to rant about as long as the movie is more than 20 years old. You can find the podcast website at paleo-cinema.com. The voicemail number is 206-350-5440. Or you can email or send MP3 voicemails to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast usually contains swearing and is probably not safe for work unless you work in a brothel or a David Mamet film.
Hi and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 102. My name is Terry Frost and this time around I'm doing something a little bit different. I've got to keep it fresh, got to keep it lively, got to keep the audience interested. And what I'm going to do is kind of go through a list of actors and actresses, which are now generically known as actors, of course, that I really like in old films, and maybe give a couple of recommendations of the films from the work of that particular actor, actress, that I think people should check out. So I'm going to do a little bit of that. It's a bit different, it's out of the format, but I kind of want to do this for a couple of reasons. One, there are a lot of people I'm not going to be able to hit very well in the podcast by other means. And two, the plans I had originally for this podcast kind of fell through. Basically, I was going to do the next part of the A to Z project, the letter Q. And I picked two movies out of what I had, started with the letter Q, and I watched them. And I wasn't particularly interested in talking about them for some reason. I don't know why. They're not particularly bad films, and I will get back to the Q part of the A to Z project. But they didn't grab me right now. And being the fickle and mercuric kind of person that I am, I decided to go with Plan B, which was to do a checklist of cool and groovy actors. They're not necessarily A-list actors. They're not household names. They're not Bogart, Bacall, or Gary Cooper, anyone like that. But just really interesting. Maybe some of them are going to be B actors, you know, like character actors. Some of them are going to be kind of stars that didn't quite make it and that kind of thing. But I'm going to do a bit of a checklist on that. So, hope everyone's well. It's going nicely here. I'm back doing the radio gig again, which is a bit lovely. I'm not sure whether I mentioned it last time, but if I have, please excuse me for it. I was off for a couple of weeks doing the radio gig. Ivor was doing outside broadcasts. There was a bit of a hiatus. He went on a week's holiday. So we didn't get together for about a month. In that month, they got a few, more than a few, emails and letters and text messages to the studio asking when I'd be back. Ivor told me about this. We actually got a couple more after we got back saying, I'm glad he's back. So that's, I'm getting a bit of a swelled head about it to a certain extent, but what I also am trying to do is, it's a weird thing with this kind of stuff. I'm pleased that that's occurring, but I don't want to get up myself about it. It's a very Australian way of going about things. But I did feel very, very pleased and touched by it. And other people at the studio, ABC Darwin, are looking to use me in future for other things. So that's quite fun and quite interesting. Nobody else does what I do up there, which is why they have to come to Melbourne to find somebody who can waffle on about films the way I do. But it is getting noticed, and I really do enjoy it. I love Ivor. He's a lovely guy, really supportive, really nice guy. He's now a friend. And it's just something I didn't expect to happen. I've kind of been reflecting back on it. And I didn't expect this to happen. And having that kind of regular gig is really, really life-affirming for me. It's a great part of my life to do that. I go into the studio. For instance, I went yesterday. Last week we did The Time Machine. Rod Taylor's The Time Machine. I talked about that. And it was played on Thursday. And then last night, Friday night, I went in and we talked about Kiss Me Deadly, the Ralph Meeker, Mickey Spillane movie. And had a good time with that. Just as I was going into the booth, out of the booth came one of the a major politician, Sarah Hanson-Young, who is a Greens senator for the Greens Party, and who has a very high media profile and is quite up there in the Green Party. And I thought, geez, I'm kind of sharing space with movers and shakers now. This is crazy. And so I went in there. We did the gig, and it was a lot of fun. Talking about Kiss Me Deadly, it kind of hits all the buttons for Ivor. He likes film noir. He likes movies that have got a little extra thing. That he likes movies that are off their time. And yeah, but that is going exceptionally well, and it's crazy, but there we go with it. So I'm going to get into what I've been watching now that I've stroked my ego sufficiently. And it wasn't my intention to do that. I really am surprised and delighted by what's going on up in Darwin there. It really, it's a cool thing. And I really don't want to lose it if I can avoid losing it. But here we go. I'll get on to what I've been watching. See, I was filling time in then while I loaded up the Mizo. I'm up the other end of the house and the Wi-Fi isn't as quick as it is down closer to the modem. So, blah, 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 blah. This is a lot harder since I cut down on the coffee, I tell you. Not as wired and not as glib for some reason. But anyway, here's what I've been watching. I watched It Came From Outer Space, the 3D 1950s science fiction movie, and it holds up really well. I kind of like it. I like the, again, one of the lovely things I like about movies from that era is, particularly when they involve science fiction, is the way that they tried to show really cool and extra otherworldly things while they didn't have the technology to just CGI the whole lot of it. I love that kind of, it's almost artisanal special effects making. And it's really a lovely thing to think that people had to think of how they're going to do that rather than just which software will I do it in. Well, yeah, basically having things a lot easier than they did. So that was fun. I saw Vamp, the vampire movie from the 1980s with Grace Jones in it. One of the cool things about Vamp I really like is the fact that they used a whole bunch of 1950s nightclub music in it, like Louis Prima and people like that. And that was a bit of fun. It was very kind of 1980s VHS kind of movie, but I'm quite fond of it, and it was a little bit interesting. I showed Sal a movie that she hadn't seen before, which is The Party with Peter Sellers, and she really enjoyed it. I heard her laughing a couple of times. She went, yeah, it's okay, after we watched it, but while she was watching it, she was chuckling away to herself and just enjoying the silliness of it. I think in a way it's you've got to get past Peter Sellers doing the blackface, basically playing the Indian guy. I think once you get past that, you can enjoy the film. But it's one of the things, from our point of view, that works against it being an effective comedy, in the fact that, you know, this guy's not Indian, he's playing an Indian thing, it's blackface. But once you get past that, it's kind of cool. I did this really, really weird thing where I just wanted to see, while I was on holidays, how many movies I could watch in a day. Ended up watching 7 films in a day. I would have got more, but I picked a couple of long films. So the movies I watched North by Northwest on Blu-ray, because I always like that, and I like the way Hitchcock moves a story along, and the way he takes you from one thing to another, and suddenly in retrospect you ever realise how implausible that motion is. But I watched that. I saw The French Connection for the first time in about 20 years. I picked up Blu-ray of French Connection 1 and 2 because it was going very cheaply locally. And yeah, it's almost documentary, isn't it? It's apart from that fantastic car chase with those great big old cars underneath the elevated railway, it really does play a little bit documentary and works really well. It was in a way, it was the first of its kind of realistic cop films. And revisiting it was fun. And seeing young Roy Scheider and Gene Hackman actually getting laid in a movie was quite unusual. I did see the David Fincher Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. It's not a bad film, I'll say that. I like the original better. I like Noomi Rapace better as Elizabeth Solander than Rooney Mara. But having said that, it works well, and I think one of the things that Finch has done with it is made it more accessible to Anglophone audiences. So he's kind of played that card and taken it there. Daniel Craig's pretty okay. Stellan Skarsgård is good in it. It kind of brings me back to why remake it. And people can have that argument. I do have friends who like the remake better than the original because one of them has multiple sclerosis and she has trouble reading subtitles. And, of course, a dub version really sucks if you can even find a dub version of it. But, from my point of view, I prefer the original. Let's see. I'm just trying to find the other films that I watched. I watched iRobot, the silly Will Smith movie directed by an Australian director, Alex Proyas. Apart from a couple of details, it's almost exactly the same film as Denzel Washington's Virtuosity. You've got a cop going up against an AI kind of creature. Cop is a black man. Cop has a robot arm. It's incredibly similar in the movies, apart from the fact that Russell Crowe plays the robot in the Virtuosity version of it. So it's really interesting to watch those two films back to back. Well, I did see a movie called The Best Spoke Overcoat. It's a short film based on a Yiddish short story about a tailor who meets a ghost. And that was kind of good. It's a 1940s, I think, late 1940s English film. And it runs about 33 minutes, but it's beautifully intense and evocative little piece of work. If you can find it around the place, it might be an interesting way to spend half an hour to watch The Best Spoke Overcoat. It stars Alfie Bass and David Kossoff. I did see Le Mans, the Steve McQueen movie, which again is another movie that's more documentary than film, in a way. Looks great on Blu-ray. I picked up the Blu-ray very, very cheaply, like $10 or something. I thought I'd give it a go. And the car racing scenes at Le Mans are very well done. I don't think it's a great narrative film. I don't think McQueen really stretched himself in the role. But there is some really, really nice second unit in it when they're setting up for the race. There's a prolonged sequence at the start of setting up people who are camping out, waking up and going around the place, all done documentary style. And from that point of view, it's an interesting film. Let's see what else I've seen. Did rewatch It's Always Fair Weather, which I've been comparing it to Singing in the Rain. It's a Gene Kelly musical, 1950s MGM musical, and I prefer it to Singing in the Rain. I think it's a little more adult and a little more interesting from that point of view. But yeah, if you haven't seen It's Always Fair Weather, it really is. And if you like musicals, it really is a lot of fun. I did watch Der Blaue Engel, The Blue Angel, with Marlene Dietrich from the very early 1930s. It also has the first actor to ever win a Best Actor Oscar in it. Unfortunately, he turned out to be a Nazi with it. And that, of course, was Emil Jannings, or Jannings, depending on your pronunciation. Odd that he became a Nazi because he was born Swiss. But anyway, yeah, that was really good. It's to see a young and slightly pudgier Marlene Dietrich. You can understand why she became a star. She really does have a sexuality and a sensuality about her, and a worldliness that came through in that film in a really good way. There are two versions. There's an English language version and the German one. I watched the German one about 2 years ago. I got a box set of the best of non-English language cinema. I won it from the World Movies Channel. It's actually two box sets. So there are things like Fritz Lang's Metropolis and a whole bunch of other good stuff in there, Beauty and the Beast, a bunch of other things like that. But yeah, I hadn't seen it before, and I thought I'll get it out there. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. I think it's the story arc is of its time, but it does show you kind of between the wars Germany and the kind of financial desperation that people were in at the time due to the hyperinflation and a bunch of other things. So there's a little bit of sociological background to that. And yeah, I'd recommend that to anybody who's interested in that sort of film. What else do I watch? I watched The Descendants with George Clooney. Recommend it. I'm not going to talk too much about it, but I recommend it. I think it is a good, solid film. And I think that it does, its narrative is a bit different. And it's nice to see. I really admire Clooney for the fact that he doesn't just try the easy stuff. He doesn't keep doing the stuff he knows is going to make money. And he is trying to stretch himself, and all power to him for that, because this is an interesting story told in a very interesting way, and it's worth your attention. That's all I'm going to talk about from the stuff that I've done. I'm going to take a little break now. My throat is going a bit dry, which means I've been talking too long, and when I get back, I'll start that list of interesting actors for you.
Tingle with merriment, what Jerry meant, I'll never know. So was I, under the eastern sky. She was applying her powder puff, a louder puff I'd never heard. Perched on her head, her hat was, oh, what a summer that was. Show me a rose, I'll show you a girl who cares. Show me a rose, or leave me alone. Show me a rose, I'll show you a stag at bay. Show me a rose, or leave me alone. Me how to do the tango down where the palm trees swayed. I called her Rosa Mia, and she called a spade. Show me a rose, I'll show you a storm at sea. Show me a rose, or leave me alone. In eastern Pennsylvania, we watched the clouds roll by. I said, my dear, how are you? And she whispered, so am I. Show me a rose, I'll show you a girl named Sam. Show me a rose, or stay where you are. Make believe that you don't know me until you show me a rose.
That was Zero Mostel with Show Me a Rose. It's from an album that I ripped off for vinyl called Songs My Mother Never Sang. And basically, they're all really, really silly songs by a guy called Harry Ruby, who was a songwriter in the middle part of the 20th century. And none of them make any sense, and all of them are totally silly, but I've got a real fondness for them. I like them a lot. So I'm going to play a couple more of those before the podcast is over, because we don't have enough silliness in our lives these days. And if Zero Mostel can just add that little increment of silliness to your life, I'm happy with that. Okay, so get your pens and papers out, because here come the actors that I really like that I think don't get enough love. First one, I've really got to do this one. Even though I've spoken about a movie that this person is in, I think she really deserves a bit more attention, and she's very, very interesting. It's Thelma Ritter, an American actress who was born in 1902 and died in 1969. She played working class characters, and the reason why I want to do Thelma Ritter, apart from anything else, is she was nominated for the Best Supporting Actress Oscar 6 times. She in 1950 for All About Eve, in 1951 for The Mating Season, in 1952 for With a Song in My Heart, in 1953 for Pick Up on South Street, in 1959 for Pillow Talk, and in 1962 for Birdman of Alcatraz. 6 times she was nominated, didn't win, which is quite a tragedy in my thing. She was nominated 3 times for the Best Supporting Actress Golden Globe Award for All About Eve, The Mating Season, and Boeing in 1965. She got the Best Actress in a Musical in 1957 for New Girl in Town. She tied with Glenn Verdon for it, so she also worked on stage. Now, the interesting thing about Thelma Ritter as a stage actress is she didn't make a movie until she was 45 years old. In 1947, she had an uncredited brief bit as a frustrated mother in Miracle on 34th Street. So, 45 years old, then makes a movie, goes on to be nominated for Best Supporting Actress 6 times. And she's fantastic. Anybody who has seen her, I think that the definitive role for Thelma Ritter in a movie was Pick Up on South Street, where she played Mo, the police informant who also sold ties on the street. And her death scene in that is heartbreaking. I've talked about that when I did talk about Pick Up on South Street. And I'm not going to play the audio from that. I'm going to let you discover that one yourself. But she also had a real touch for comedy. And the bit I'm going to play for you is from Pillow Talk in 1959. She plays Doris Day's housekeeper, who is a little bit fond of the drink. And she's approached by Rock Hudson's character because he wants to get to know Doris Day's character. And they meet at a bus stop. You'll see her say, go away to the bus. And then they proceed to a bar. And if you hear a thumping noise at any time during this audio clip, it is Rock Hudson's head hitting the table.
Excuse me. May I talk to you?
Yes.
My name is Brad Allen, and I...
Mr. Allen, of course. Get lost. I'd know that voice of yours anywhere.
You know me?
You are my inspiration, Alma.
Oh, the telephone.
I'm one of your most devoted listeners.
Why, thank you.
That's all right.
Oh, well, couldn't we, it's a little chilly out here. Couldn't we stop in and have a drink somewhere?
Oh, no, I don't usually, I might have one just to be sociable.
Good. Good. I know a nice little bar right down the street.
I know a better one. You ready for another one? No?
No.
Now let's take this problem from the beginning. You're in love with her, and you want to win her back. First thing you got to do is to get her to talk to you. Right?
Right.
Really very simple. You've got an apartment. She decorates apartments. You hire her to do your place. two people decorating an apartment. That's pretty intimate. She's got to talk to you. Clever?
Clever.
And once you start talking, it's only a matter of time. Now remember, you hire her to decorate your apartment. Okay?
Okay.
Happy?
Happy.
Would you care for a little snack of some kind?
I love that scene because he's drinking Rock Hudson under the table with a bottle of vodka. Thelma Ritter actually hosted the Oscars at one stage too. In 1954, she co-hosted the Oscars with Bob Hope, and they wisecracked together. It'd be lovely to get some footage of that, but I wasn't able to find any. But as far as those nominations are concerned, being nominated for the Oscar 6 times, she's tied with another two actresses on the most nominations without a win. Deborah Carr and Glenn Close also were nominated and hadn't won. The current record for actors without winning an Oscar are Peter O'Toole, who got 8 nominations without a win. Richard Burton got 7 nominations. Deborah Carr and Peter O'Toole received honorary Oscars, however, which is a bit of a shame. I think they should do a posthumous honorary Oscar for Thelma Ritter. I think she really contributed to movies, and I think she was one of those people in cinema who had a distinctive style. She did play posh a few times. She wasn't always playing working-class kind of characters. In Move Over, Darling, she played a very upper-class mother to the protagonist in the film. I think it was James Garner in this one. But she really did have a distinctive style, and I like her a lot. I like the fact that she wasn't a beautiful bimbo in cinema. She was a real-looking person and a very, very fine talent in cinema. Okay, going to the other end of things. Next person I want to talk about is Charles Laughton. Charles Laughton I like a lot for a number of reasons. I think that he had a lot working against him as an actor, but he overcame it all, which was really interesting. There's a great biography of Laughton by another actor, by Simon Callow. I'll let you know what it's called as soon as I find it on the shelf here. There we go. It's just hidden behind the biography of Marlon Brando and Clark Gable. It's called Charles Laughton, A Difficult Actor, and it is a really good biography. He started out his life in... he wasn't from a wealthy background at all. He started out in Scarborough. His parents owned a hotel there. He went through the West End and the Old Vic, and of course went on to Broadway and Hollywood. And the things that Charles Laughton had working against him as a cinema actor, he was ugly. I'm not going to kind of put anything around that, but the guy was not a pretty person. And even at a young age, he had a fleshy kind of face. His hairline was a bit weird. He had big fleshy lips and didn't have... he wasn't anyone's idea of a matinee idol at all. But he was an extremely good actor. I'm just looking through the biography now. He married the actress Elsa Lanchester at a fairly early age for the both of them. They were together in 1928. And he was gay. He was gay all of his life. And they had a kind of companionate marriage. They were very, very close. As if you were listening last week to the music podcast I did a little bit of Elsa Lanchester singing a ditty with Charles Laughton introducing her. So they were all through the life, right until he died in the 60s. They were very, very close and very nicely paired, except in sexuality. And that's a kind of an interesting phenomenon, that they weren't there to hide anything from anybody. People kind of knew that Charles Laughton was gay and that the marriage wasn't sexually passionate, but they were very well respected in Hollywood particularly. And there is that story as well of emigre actors who came over from Europe when the Nazis were starting to take over countries and kill particularly Jewish actors and homosexuals and intellectuals in general, en masse. And a lot of these actors were put under curfew. They weren't allowed to leave their home after sunset. And Charles Laughton, in particular, spent time going to the house where these people were staying and keeping them company and just reinforcing them. He did a lot of stuff during the war for the war effort. But everything I've read of Charles Laughton, apart from him being an extremely fine actor, shows him to be a humanitarian at a time when it wasn't necessary. In fact, it could have been dangerous in Hollywood, particularly. I'm talking about in the 50s, to be a humanitarian. But Charles Laughton was, and really did give back. He, for instance, went around schools. He did some work in schools, doing little bits and pieces from various plays for children to get them encouraged to have an interest in the arts and things like that. He was a promoter and an educator, amongst anything else. Yeah, and he had a troubled life. His demons were pretty apparent, and I can't imagine what it would have been like to live in a time when your sexuality was dangerous to your career, to your freedom from prosecution and from imprisonment. It's just nightmarish to think that people who have what we now consider to be an acceptable sexuality were persecuted in that way. It seems unthinkably cruel to me that occurred, but Laughton did. And of course, he directed one very, very fine movie as well, and never got another chance to do it again, which was it was Hollywood's loss in a lot of ways when he directed Night of the Hunter in 1955 of Robert Mitchum. And he and Mitchum got along famously well. I think I mentioned it when I talked about Night of the Hunter in the podcast. They did get along really, really well, in spite of their differences. They were both sensitive actors in the sense that they were very attuned to emotions. Mitchum hid it a lot, but at one stage, Laughton did say to him, "Do you realise I'm homosexual?" And he went, "I don't care." And that was the right attitude to have. But Charles Laughton, I'm going to find a little bit of an audio clip now of Charles Laughton to play. But the roles he played were many and varied. But I'll play the audio clip first, and then I'll kind of go through a little bit of a list of the roles that Charles Laughton did that I find particularly groovy. Actually, I've changed my mind. I'll go through the movies first, and then I'll play this clip, because I found a clip, and excuse me for the squeaking chair, I found a clip that really is something special. But, yeah, Laughton was born in 1899, died in 1962, and looking at the film roles that I find particularly good and particularly fun, I really like him in The Island of Lost Souls. I liked him in that a lot, playing Dr. Moreau. And you might look back on a previous podcast where I did a movie called The Bribe from about 1949 or 1950. I'm just trying to find out which one it was. 1949, where he played a guy called J.J. Beeler, a slimy kind of character who had trouble with his feet. He was really good in that as well. I actually talked about that one recently on the radio. I like him in The Big Clock, playing Janoth, the publishing tycoon. He was great in that. I like him in Spartacus as well, playing the Roman senator. Another one of those kind of slyly witty roles. Gracchus was the character's name. Advice and Consent, I've talked about him in that on a podcast before, when he played Senator C. Briculli. It was his last acting role. And a very fine one as well. And then you can go back on things like Hobson's Choice, where he was great in that. Mutiny on the Bounty, of course. There are just so many Charles Laughton roles. And, of course, his Hunchback of Notre Dame in, I think, about 1939. In 1939, that was the first version of the Hunchback of Notre Dame I ever saw, and the poignancy that Laughton brought to the role. Yes, of course, we've got Lon Chaney Sr. in the silent version, and I'm not trying to take anything away from that. But Quasimodo having a voice in the 1939 version was superb, and Laughton, even through that hideous and quite layered makeup, really did make you feel for the character in a lot of ways, and as a physical acting role as well as an emotional one. It's probably the role of his that really first brought him to my attention. I was only a kid when I saw it, and I really should track down a copy of that film as well, because I wouldn't mind owning a copy of it. But if you were going to go to a go-to movie for Charles Laughton, I'd go Hunchback of Notre Dame. I'd definitely go Night of the Hunter if you want to see him as a director. And probably something like The Bribe would be good. Or, let's face it, anything Laughton was in is worth. He's one of those actors that if you see that he's in a movie that's upcoming somewhere on TV, or if you get an opportunity to get a movie with him in it. He was really good as the lawyer too, the barrister in Witness for the Prosecution with Tyrone Power and Marlene Dietrich. That'd be another one I'd check out. But anything with Charles, he's a bit like Stanley Tucci is for me. Anything that's got Stanley Tucci in it, I'll at least watch, because I like Stanley Tucci as an actor. And Charles Laughton's very much in the same vein for me. Now, I'm going to play a clip now. It's something I was looking through YouTube to find something to kind of represent Charles Laughton in the podcast. And I found something very cool. I found a radio bit of Charles Laughton and Elsa Lanchester singing Baby, It's Cold Outside. And I'm just going to play that now to end off this little spiel about Charles Laughton.
Outside.
I've got to go away.
It's cold outside.
This evening has
been hoping that you drop
so very nice.
I'll hold your hands. They're just
my mother will stop to
beautiful, what's your
and father
hurry?
Will be pacing the floor.
Listen to the fireplace
so really I'd better scurry.
Beautiful, please don't
well,
hurry.
Maybe just a half a drink
put
more.
Put some records on while I pour. Baby, it's bad out there.
Hey, what's in this
no
drink?
No cabs to be had out there.
I wish I knew how.
Starlight
you break
now.
The spell.
I'll take your hat. Your hair looks swell.
Or to say no, no, no,
mind if
sir.
I move in
at least
closer.
I'm going to say that I tried.
What's the sense of hurting my
I
pride?
I really can't say.
Oh, no.
Ah, but it's cold outside. Simply must go.
It's cold outside.
The answer is no.
It's cold outside.
The welcome has
lucky
been
that you dropped
so
in.
Nice and warm.
Look out the window at that
my
storm. Gosh, your lips look delicious.
My brother will be there at the
waves
door.
Upon a tropical
my
shore.
My main mind is delicious.
Gosh, your lips are delicious.
Well, maybe just a cigarette more.
Never such a blizzard
I've
before.
I've got to get home.
Baby, you'll freeze out there.
Say, lend me a coat.
Drop your knees out there.
But don't you see?
How can you do this thing to me?
There's bound to be talk tomorrow.
Think of my lifelong sorrow.
There will be plenty implied.
If you caught pneumonia and
really
died,
can't
get over that old doubt.
Ah, but it's cold
Next actor I want to talk about is one that I'll watch in anything again, and it's Nicole Williamson. He's a British actor, lived from 1936 to 2011. Let's see where he's born. Scotland, actually. He's a Scottish actor. My apologies to everyone in Scotland. He died in Amsterdam on 16th of December last year. Now, he was mostly known as a stage actor, very kind of long and lugubrious face to him. He did like singing jazz standards as well. There's a really good interview come profile on Nicole Williamson written by Kenneth Tynan, which takes place just as he's going to do a kind of gig at the White House in front of Nixon. And Williamson, he's a heavy drinker, he's a heavy smoker, he was plagued with self-doubt. He had all of the failings that we think about when we think about actors. And in spite of that, he was an extremely fine actor. He was the best Hamlet of his generation in the 1960s. If you see his Hamlet, which has been recorded from 1969, really, really good Hamlet. The things I like him most in, there are a couple of films which aren't particularly large films, but I'm very fond of him in both of them. The first one is a 7% Solution, the Sherlock Holmes meets Sigmund Freud, played by Alan Arkin movie, which I like for a lot of reasons, but I do like the Sherlock Holmes that Nicole Williamson brings to the game. He hadn't read any of the books, so I hadn't seen any of the movies about Holmes, and he came at it fresh and reinvented it. A kind of addicted, haunted Sherlock Holmes. Very intelligent, very manic, and very kind of jittery. But at the end of the film, as he kind of gets his shit together, a very touching Sherlock Holmes, and you think of him tenderly and fondly by the end of the film. His Dr. Watson was actually played by Robert Duvall, which was an interesting choice, and Duvall does a very, very good job of it. Now, it's based on the novel by Nicholas Meyer, and that's one of the two roles that I really enjoy Nicole Williamson in. The other one's a kind of... it's set in South Africa. It's called The Wilby Conspiracy. It's from 1975. The stars of the movie are Michael Caine and Sidney Poitier. But there's a really good character role in there that Nicole Williamson plays, Major Horn, who's a copper from the Bureau of State Security in South Africa who's chasing a guy called Wilby, who is the head. He's kind of like the Nelson Mandela of this particular story. And Michael Caine plays an Englishman who gets involved with another rebel, played by Sidney Poitier. But Major Horn, the South African copper, played by Nicole Williamson, very smart, very intelligent, great South African accents. He does a perfect South African accent in the movie. And he's got all of the flaws of the apartheid regime. He's arrogant. He's got the sense of entitlement. He's patronising, and he's just one of the great unsung movie villains. I really should do the Wilby Conspiracy on the podcast one day, but Nicole Williamson in that gives you a really hateful character, and yet, because of the way the story is written, you come to see his point of view without accepting it. He's trying to protect everything that he wants in South Africa and everything he believes is good about South Africa, basically being white rule and the rights of white people to be the masters of the land. And the character really does believe this. So in that sense, he's an evil character, but he's not a black and white character. He's actually doing things for what he believes are good reasons. And that's always a sign of good writing, where the villains have as much of a rationale and as much of a motivation as the heroes do. And in that, he is really good. He also played a really nice version of Little John in Robin and Marian, the kind of older Robin Hood story with Sean Connery and Audrey Hepburn. And he was a good Little John in that. A few of the other roles he did, he was Merlin in Excalibur. I haven't seen Excalibur for a very long time, so I can't recall how good he was in that off the top of my head. Let's see, there's a few other bits and pieces here. He was in Black Widow, the Bob Rafelson movie in 1987. Let's have a look. He was in Venom, that really weird terrorist movie, as I recall, with Klaus Kinski and Oliver Reed in it. He was the copper in that one. I also had Sarah Miles, Sterling Hayden's in that, Susan George is in that as well, Michael Goff's in it. I haven't seen that for a few years, but the weird thing about that film, I'm just looking at this now, Klaus Kinski chose to do Venom over Raiders of the Lost Ark. He was going to be one of the villains in Raiders of the Lost Ark, and he stated that the script that Spielberg gave him was moronically shitty. But getting back to Nicole Williamson, a fine actor, a really good actor, a really troubled actor, didn't do nearly enough work on the screen from my point of view. He did do a lot of stuff on stage, and he did a number of John Osborne's plays and was looked at as the go-to actor for any John Osborne plays. I'll just give you a little bit of Nicole Williamson's Hamlet, just to give you a little bit of an idea of it. But he really is one of those kind of actors that when you're watching the movie, he brings it across beautifully. Does draw attention to his acting a little bit, but the way he does it, I don't really see that as a flaw. I see it as letting you in on what he's doing, in a sense. As I said, he was a jazz musician as well, Williamson. And I've gone to his website, and they've got a link to a YouTube video of him singing Got the World on a String with a little band he sang with. And I thought I'd play that as a way of kind of remembering Nicole Williamson and the stuff that he brought to us all.
I've got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got the string around my finger. What a world, what a life. I'm in love with a lass. What a gas is she, sassy class. I've got a song that I sing. I can make the rain go when I move my finger. Lucky me, can't you see? I'm in love. Life is a beautiful thing, as long as I've got hold of that string. I'd be a silly old so-and-so if I should ever let it go. I've got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got that string around my finger. What a world, what a life, I'm in love. Beautiful thing, as long as I've got hold of that string. I'd be a silly old so-and-so if I should ever let it go. I've got the world on a string, sitting on that rainbow. Got the string around my finger. What a world, what a life. Ah, what a world, what a life. What a world, what a life. I'm in love. Do I love playing with that yo-yo?
Best place to go if you want to get a look at some of Nicole Williamson's work is if you go to nicolewilliamson.com. There are a lot of embedded YouTube clips of his work, and it's quite fun to play around in that and take a look at some of the work. Some of it's stage work, some of it's filmed work, but it's all good. Okay, so I'm going to play another piece of music now from Zero Mostel, and then come back. I'll do one more actor, and then we'll get into some feedback. This track is called My Dream of the South of France, and it's a kind of weird, nightmarish little effort.
Last night before I went to bed, I felt so hungry that I made myself a nice Welsh rabbit. I started in to eat and then began to think of the war and the soldiers who did their bit, and when I went to bed I saw Abraham Lincoln at Waterloo. If
defending Trafalgar Square. I saw Grant and Lee take the port away from Stonewall Jackson at Manila Bay. I saw Washington capture the Philippines from the pirates of Penzance. And they all fought for the USA in my dream of the south of France. Sheridan sinking the Spanish fleet while the band play the skater's waltz. I saw Sherman march onto Bunker Hill. He came in time to rescue Buffalo Bill. I saw Eisenhower crossing the Delaware while the Viet Cong looked askance. And they all fought for the USA in my dream of the south of France.
The last of the four actors I'm going to talk about is Stephen Boyd, who was an Irish actor who worked predominantly in America and a little bit in Europe. He was born in 1931 and died in 1977, so he was 46 years old, roughly. He was playing golf in Northridge, California, and had a heart attack while playing golf with his wife. But he did have a body of work, and one of the interesting things about the career of Stephen Boyd is the fact that he almost got to the heights. He didn't quite get there, but he almost got there. Now, he was born in County Antrim in Northern Ireland, and he started out doing stage work, and he was one of that kind of 1950s school of Irish actors, very intense, very masculine, very good-looking. So he started out, the first film he made, he paid an Irish spy in a World War II film called The Man Who Never Was in 1956. That's when he first really came to people's attention. He actually did a Brigitte Bardot movie in 1957 called The Night Heaven Fell. I'm going to have to try to find that one. So he had a few other bits. He played Messala in Ben-Hur, and of course he was in The Chariot Race and got stomped. And as I've said before in the podcast, my preference in that movie was for Stephen Boyd to win the chariot race. I found his character, Messala, to be a much more interesting and vivid character than Ben-Hur himself, played by Charlton Heston. Now, if you disagree or agree, just let me know. But one way or the other, Stephen Boyd did have a lot of charisma. He was originally going to play Mark Antony in the Elizabeth Taylor 20th Century Fox epic Cleopatra. He was contracted for that. And that movie, of course, had a long and awkward birth, and he withdrew from the project because he had another commitment on another film. It was delayed because Elizabeth Taylor was ill. And the sets they originally built in England all got waterlogged and mankied up, and eventually they moved the filming to Cinecittà Studios in Rome. There's this whole documentary about how fucked up the making of that film was. And of course, they got Richard Burton to become Mark Antony. Burton and Taylor fell in love, and things went on from there. So that was his big chance to really make it big in cinema, and it didn't happen because of the fucked up genesis of that particular film. So he did do, of course, Fall of the Roman Empire, which is a very stodgy epic of the type in 1963. And he's also in one of the worst movies of the 1960s, which really knocked his career on his ass. He was in The Bible, the John Huston-directed movie The Bible in 66, Genghis Khan in 65. He's in Billy Rose's Jumbo opposite Doris Day and Jimmy Durante in 1962, but he did the Oscar. I've talked about the Oscar in the podcast. It's one of those movies that's, you can't take your eyes off the screen bad. The dialogue by Harlan Ellison is very vivid but weird. Tony Bennett has his first acting role in the movie, and if you know why Tony Bennett is now still a jazz singer, the reason is the Oscar. He was a shit actor. to be honest with you. But the movie itself was rather interesting for that particular reason. I'd heard about it for years and I hadn't got a chance to see it, but I finally saw it, and yep, it's an interesting bit of cinema. He was also in Fantastic Voyage for people who are into the science fiction films. He was the male lead. Now he was in Shalako with Sean Connery and Honor Blackman in 1968, and did a spy movie called Assignment K in 1969. But and then, of course, in 77, dropped off the twig. He'd done TV and a few other things. But one of the weird things about it is that arc. He was an up-and-comer. But one movie that was delayed and basically nightmarish kind of stopped him from reaching orbit. He failed in that. I think he had the ability to do it. He did a lot of really good stage acting in Ireland before he went into cinema as well. Things like Juno and the Peacock and all those classic Irish plays. He was incredibly good in that. So he had acting chops. Just didn't have the opportunity, which is a little bit unfortunate. Now, I'm just reading through his Wikipedia page here, and there's some interesting bits and pieces. In February 2012, Raquel Welch outed him as a gay actor. And, of course, Gore Vidal had mentioned that he was gay as well, so that's an interesting one. I know he's very devoted to his mother. He was married twice. Once to executive in the business called Mariella Di Sarzana for a total of 3 weeks, and he was married to a secretary for the British Arts Council called Elizabeth Mills, who was about 15 years older than him. So from the look of things, he was gay, and they were basically beards for him. So yeah, I mean, I like Stephen Boyd. I think he had the dynamism about it. And, of course, then there's that old trope about was Masala in love with Ben-Hur, and Boyd did play it that way. But I do like him as an actor. I'll just go through a few other films of his that I kind of enjoy as well. Let's see. There's a really good little thriller from 1964 called The Third Secret, which, if you haven't seen it, you really should. It was directed by Charles Crichton. And I'm not going to give too many spoilers for that film, because it would be nice for you to find it and investigate it yourself. Zom, you would particularly like that film if you haven't seen it before. Really well made, but not really well known. Let's see. There's a caper film we did called The Caper of the Golden Bulls in 1967, which has a great Vic Mizzi soundtrack to it, which you can find out. You can find around the place a little bit. But, Stephen Boyd, I always liked him as an actor. Maybe it's my latent homosexuality coming out, who knows. If it is latent, it's bloody latent, I can tell you. But, Stephen Boyd, I really liked as an actor. I liked him in Ben-Hur. And I really do think that he is one of those actors who had the ability, but not the opportunity. So, that's the fourth of the four actors. We've got Thelma Ritter, we have Charles Laughton, we have Nicole Williamson, and we have Stephen Boyd there. So, I'm just going to take a small break now, and when I get back, I've got a bit of feedback to pass along and finish up this podcast.
There's a memory that will cling to me if I live forever and a day. I will never forget how I and my loved one met and our romance came our way. I was an incubator baby, and she was the girl next door. I turned my head, smiled at her and said, "Darling, you're the one I've been waiting for." It was a case of love at first sight. The first kiss made my hopes soar. I've been happy and yet
I always will regret that we hadn't met before. I was an incubator baby, and she was the girl next door. That it was forevermore. Now I look back and see why my life used to be so empty for me before. I was an incubator baby, and she was the girl next door.
Okay, I got an email from Morris over at the Love That Album podcast. I'll just bring that up here. It's a regard to the 100th Paleo Cinema. Sorry, I'm a bit late getting this one through. I've got an email that says, "Hey Terry, between last night and the train ride into work this morning, I'm about 10 minutes from the end of Paleo Cinema 100. It was a lot of fun to listen to. Sal certainly seems to be enjoying herself. I hope that on a future episode you can get Richard from Wichita or Rupert. Are you a fan of King of Comedy, by the way, to co-partner? Love the obvious passion for film. As much as I like the blog, I'm amazed Rupert doesn't do a podcast of his own. I must say, I've never been interested in the whole James Bond franchise, maybe because the only film I ever saw in its entirety was The Spy Who Loved Me at the cinema. It did nothing for me except for watching Barbara Bach. I was 13 years old, after all, so you can understand where my interest lay. Anyway, after my your hearty recommendation, maybe I'll grab one of the first two out of the library and watch with Max. I went to the Seven Arts in Hawthorne yesterday. Check it out if you haven't already done so, for a really great film lover's store. And based on Zom's passion for it, I ordered The Friends of Eddie Coyle. I watched a couple of parts of it on YouTube and was blown away about how good it was. The bits I saw were low-key but menacing. I think Dave Grusin was the wrong composer for this type of film, and I don't usually mind him. But otherwise, this started out fantastic, so I can't wait for my DVD to arrive. I imagine this is a film you love. Anyway, have a great week. Maybe we can meet up next week or two for another drink. Cheers, Morris." We haven't met up for the drink yet, but we will meet up for the drink. Friends of Eddie Coyle I saw a long time ago, but it's one of those later Mitchum films which is really good. I'm going to have to revisit it myself. Haven't done so in a long time, but it's one of those things, so many films, so little time and so much work. But thanks for that, Morrison. Thanks for all the support again for the podcast. And people should go over to Love That Album and enjoy the groovy movie wonkness of Morris's podcast. I've also got a voicemail here somewhere. He said, looking through Audacity and copying it in to be able to paste it in here. And I will do so. Won't be a sec.
Hey, Terry, it's Rupert. Just listening to episode 100. Good stuff. So I have a question Disney-related. I recently came across, I don't know how I hadn't really been aware of this program, but there's this program called Disney Rewards. I don't know if it's in Australia or not, but I know it's in the U.S. and Canada. And basically, it's anytime you buy a Disney movie or a movie ticket, you can get little points that you can use on their Disney Rewards site to buy, quote-unquote, to get other movies that they have listed there. Like, I got... You know, so I went through and each of the Blu-rays and DVDs, if you look inside, they have a little piece of paper, which I've thrown away a few of them, unfortunately, because I didn't even really pay attention. But they have little points, and you go and put the code in, and you get points. So anyway, I got the Computer Wore Tennis Shoes, and I got Super Dad, which I watched the other day, which isn't very good. But somehow it hooked me because it's about a guy and his daughter, and I'm kind of a sucker being I have a three-year-old girl, and I see myself in that place at some point. Anyway, there's one I got called So Dear to My Heart, which I had not heard of until someone on Twitter turned me onto it. And it hasn't, as far as I know, it never come. I mean, it's been released, but via this like Disney sort of club release. And I got that. And I guess it's a Walt Disney favorite. It's got some basis in his upbringing in Kansas. It's also an early mix of animation and live action. I'm excited to watch it. My little girl saw the case this morning and she was very excited. I think she wants to see it. So, but anyway, I wondered if you'd seen that movie, if you knew anything else about it, and what your thoughts were. Okay, I'll talk to you later.
Yeah, hi, Rupert, and thanks again. So, dear to my heart, I'm not really big on Disney films. I think they're a little bit vanilla for my taste. But I just looked this up. It's got an interesting cast. Harry Carey's in it. Bobby Driscoll plays the kid. Burl Ives is in it. Luana Patton's in it. Let's see. I'll read the blurb. In the earliest 20th century Indiana, it tells the tale of Jeremiah Kincaid and his quest to raise a champion lamb, Danny. Jeremiah's dream of showing Danny at the Pike County Fair must overcome the obstinate objections of his loving yet strict grandmother, played by Beulah Bondi. Jeremiah's confident uncle Hiram is the boy's steady ally. I haven't seen that, but yeah, it sounds like it's maybe a little bit interesting on there. I wish they would release Song of the South, by the way. I know that that's politically incorrect and there are some racist aspects to it, but I think you've got to take movies in the context of the idiots who made them. The kind of the way you do Birth of a Nation. Birth of a Nation's got a DVD release. I don't know why Song of the South particularly hasn't, unless it's going to be a rallying point for Tea Party enthusiasts or something like that. But I think from a historical point of view, it should be released. But Disney, the Disney organization, have chosen not to. But on the other hand, they own Marvel and they release The Avengers, so I'll give them a pass on that. Favorite Disney movie of mine probably is Three Caballeros. I know it's a little bit off the wall, but I really like the Three Caballeros. I like the kind of multiculturalism of it. And I know the reasons why America was trying to be multicultural during World War II, so the Nazis wouldn't get a foothold in South America. There was a political agenda, but there was also an opening up to other musics and other cultures at the time. And I think that Three Caballeros is amongst the most imaginative animation works that Disney ever did. But thanks for that, Rupert. And I may get you to guest. Morris's idea is a good one, getting you to guest on the podcast. We have Skype. Why the fuck don't I use it? Anyway, that's about it for this time around. Next fortnight, we're doing the second one of the Martian Drive-In podcast. So I better get my act into gear and get that organized. But in the meantime, enjoy your movie watching. Thursday night's Australian time, and I'd usually do a bit of a Facebook alert on that, is me talking with Ivor on ABC Local Radio Darwin, which you can stream on the internet. I'm not sure what time zone it is in other places, but you guys figure it out if you want to watch it. I will be getting some more recordings of those gigs with Ivor to put on the podcast. He's sending me a couple more. He may send me the three science fiction ones we just did. Village of the Damned, we did Quatermass in the Pit, and we did The Time Machine. So they'd be a good three to put together. But having said that, it's getting into the evening. I've got to spend some quality time with Sal. So take care of yourselves. Enjoy your movie watching. And I'll be back in 2 weeks with the second one of the Martian Drive-In podcast. Bye.